Good afternoon. I'm Susan McGinnis, host of Sunday at Noon. It's a program supported in part by contributions to the KUAC FM Programming Fund. Today on Sunday at Noon, a discussion of cultural relationships at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, especially relating to Alaska Native students. Is there racism at UAF? If so, what forms does it take? How does it complicate the academic and social lives of Native students at the university? And how does the university go about creating a multicultural environment for all its students, an environment which is equitable and which inspires high academic achievement, as well as being welcoming as a social environment? This is Sunday at Noon. My guests today are UAF Chancellor Pat O'Rourke, Assistant Professor of Sociology Val Montoya, Professor of Education and Anthropology, also President for the Faculty Senate David Smith, student Phil Charette, student with a double major in Native Studies and Secondary Education. Phil Charette is also an RA at Bartlett Hall. And a student who is a senior in social work, Robert Galachianoff. Thank you all for giving of your time and welcome to Sunday at Noon. I want to begin with what may be a bit of a difficult opening question, but I think it's fair if we first take a look at definitions, if we define our terms for this discussion. Racism in the lower 48, and certainly racism in our national history, has been incendiary, sometimes violent, certainly an angry force, sometimes marking hatred between racial and cultural groups. I don't know whether we can use those terms to define racism at UAF, and so I want to open it up to see what each of you thinks of that word. Chancellor O'Rourke, can we begin with you?
Sure.
Racism at UAF.
As I begin to think about the definition for that particular term, a number of things come to mind, and it might be best to try to address it in the form of a stream of consciousness. Certainly in the lower 48, over the past couple of years, we've seen some what I would consider to be disastrous incidents on college campuses that range all the way from cross-burning to reemergence of hooded Klansmen to violence of a racial nature. I don't think we have that at UAF. I think we have perhaps more of a latent form of racism or cultural separatism that exists. Seems to manifest itself in a variety of different ways. There is not the degree of intermingling and intermix necessarily amongst our students that one would expect to see in a totally open and free society. So that's one aspect of it that I do observe. I do think that we see other behavior patterns. For instance, last year we were dealing with some issues regarding incidents which resulted in calling our security force to a residence hall. And what we found when we looked into that was that head residents called security for assistance more frequently for incidents involving Alaska Native students than they did for incidents involving non-Alaska Native students. That implies to me an inability to cross a cultural gap adequately to deal on an interpersonal one-to-one relationship more than might exist in other societies. I'm afraid I'm not doing real well at defining it. But
I think we're getting a good start. That's Val Montoya, would you like to continue?
Okay, I guess I'd like to add to this idea of cultural separation. I think in terms of looking at multiculturalism on this campus, or lack thereof, we need to take into account that not only is there a separateness, but there's also an evaluation made in terms of one culture, quote, being superior to another culture. So I think definitely there's that aspect to lack of diversity on this campus. In terms of looking at racism and the use outside of Alaska, it's a much more radical term, and looking at it in a historical process, people say that racism is a result of really kind of a history of capitalism and economic exploitation. So it's a much more radical point of view, and I think it evokes a lot stronger emotions. And I guess I'd prefer to stick to the use of multiculturalism just to avoid some of those strong reactions, because then I think people aren't as open. Although I still think some structural change has to occur, not only attitudinal change. And I definitely think that there is an evaluation aspect to cultural diversity here on campus.
And by saying that, you mean that we evaluate one cultural group or one race as better than the other, or others as lesser than the
Yes, and also majority. In terms of looking at the university and how receptive it is to people of different cultures, there are definite barriers, which I think enhances one group's chances of success over another group's.
Okay. Robert Galatianov, have you thoughts to open?
Well, in the history of Alaska, especially in American history, not the Russian history of Alaska, there hasn't really been that much violence involved with, and like you said, blatant racism. And I think the United States has always treated Alaska Natives differently than they have treated American Indians in the Lower 48. And I think it kind of continued on to today is the treatment, because even today BIA treats them differently, and also United people in general treat Alaska Natives differently than they treat Lower 48 Indians, and they have their ideas of what Alaska Natives are like, and also they have their own different ideas of what American Indians are like, and of course they're the same people, but a lot of times people don't see them as one person. They see them as two different types of people. Like, I don't know if this is true, but I've heard that at one point the government, Alaskan government, they have said things like they treat Alaskan Natives differently because they're different. And that's pretty much the only explanation if they can really come up with. And but as far as the university goes, as Chancellor O'Rourke said, it's not really blatant. It's kind of in the background, kind of a what I feel like kind of a indifference, separateness, but there's no real words that people use. It's just kind of like, this is how it is. It's always been this way, and we're separate, but we're not going to really do anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
But it happens more in town. The more blatant racism, it happens more in town than it does up here. I don't know, because of educational institution or what, and people are more open to ideas. But I don't think it's racism is a real problem here. There are some problems of separateness, as you said.
Okay, thank you, Robert. Phil Charette, have you comments on this to open?
Yeah, I feel pretty much the same that Robert feels. It's not there's not a lot of heavy, deep feelings about racism here on campus. I haven't felt that, but I do agree that there is some cultural separatism that does exist. But it seems to be, and from what when I deal with the students, it seems to be kind of. It's not as extreme as it was in the past. Students seem to be getting more involved cross-culturally than they've been in the past. And, from what I've seen, and I can't speak for all the students, but I can speak for what I've seen and I've observed, and that's most of the students that I've been involved with up in the dorms have cut across a lot of boundaries, and they've been making a lot of they're making a lot of progress in terms of, not having those barriers, breaking down those culturally separate barriers.
But, okay. Thank you. Phil Charette with an opening thought. David Smith, the last member of our panel.
Let me start with a little story. Yesterday I was walking across campus and I ran into one of our graduating Native students who is from a rural village who's going to one of the three top universities in the country. I'm not identifying him because I didn't ask him if I could do this. And we were chatting about that. And it's in a metropolitan area, and I was saying I'd hate to live there. And he said, well, he's really looking forward to going. And I said, why? And he said, I'm not happy here. I'm having a hard time. And it was just after our preliminary conversation, so I thought it might be an opportunity to pursue this. And I asked him why, and he said, well, for Native students, Natives in this area at UAF and in Fairbanks, he said, we have a hard time because whites seem to think they understand us. And I got to thinking about that, and I think in that comment he's captured not only the essence of racism, but of all the isms, imperialism, sexism, classism. It seems to me that the definition of isms is that one group decides on the basis of ethnic difference or some other characteristic that they understand the other group in such a way that they have a right to make decisions over their lives in this tends to be disempowering of those of that other group. And I think this is precisely the situation at UAF, and I think that this belief has two major outcomes that are both problematic. There are those who see Native students in a way in which they start with the assumption or perception of incompetence. They see Native students as being less prepared, less skilled, more prone to drop out, and more prone to fail than they do white kids. This has some important effects. First of all, it becomes a contingent reality. That is, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, and probably happens. But to a very large extent, it is a myth. It's untrue. If we look at our Native students, apart from this perception, they stack up very well with the other students who come. Leaving aside for a minute the problem of standardized entrance exams, which have another set of issues, but they stack up very well. They're just as able, it seems to me, for the most part, to make it. And in fact, they may be not much less prepared, not much less skilled than our others. So one way that this this view that we understand them and can make decisions for them has a negative implication is that we perceive them as being incompetent. The other way is almost the opposite. There are those that think they understand Alaskan Natives, but they don't necessarily start out with an assumption of incompetence. But they see them as culturally different. Therefore, they assume that they don't aspire to some of the same goals as white students. They're not in need of the same skills. They're not in need of being challenged in the same way. They don't have to. We don't have to work to help them attain academic excellence. These folks end up, for the same reason, in some way, being patronizing. In either case, we tend to treat a class of students, because of their ethnic identity, as less complicated, less conflicted, less heterogeneous, more in need of our making decisions for them than we do with white students. I think this is racism, and I think it's a serious problem.
This is, sure. Let me reintroduce everybody, because I know people tune in late. And then, if you are comfortable, let's just turn this into a roundtable. I know you had some thoughts coming up, Ed. We've got a roundtable today on Sunday at noon on racism and cultural separateness at the University of Alaska Fairbanks campus. You just listened to David Smith, who is a professor of education. We also have on this program Robert Galachanov, a student at the university, Phil Charette, a student at the University of Valmontoya, assistant professor of sociology, and Chancellor Pat O'Rourke. Pat O'Rourke, pick it up where you had a thought.
As the others were speaking, I just recalled an issue that I encountered in 1970 to 72 when I was here prior to going back to Bethel. But I had occasion to work with a rather outstanding young man at that time, Alaska Native student, who had actually come back to finish his senior year at the university. He had gone outside to a small private liberal arts college for the first 3 years. And interesting discussion one evening, I asked what he saw as differences. And he said, the interesting thing is, I'm an Alaskan Eskimo, and I went to Montana, and they didn't know what an Eskimo was. So I could be just me. When I'm here in Alaska, not just at the university, but in Fairbanks or in Anchorage or Bethel or wherever else, I can't be just me. Any action I take is a reflection not just on myself as an individual, but on my race. And so I'm always cognizant of that, and I think it's a greater burden that I have to bear because people have these preconceived notions of what an Eskimo is, and I didn't face that in Montana. I thought that was a rather telling comment, and I don't know if that still exists today in some ways.
We're getting a lot of nods around the room here from what you said. Val?
Yes, I would like to follow up a little bit on what Robert said earlier about violence and to what extent exists on campus. I think we need to have a broad idea of what violence is. I don't think it's just necessarily physical violence. I think there can be also economic, political, and social violence. So anytime we put any kind of restrictions on people, I take that as a form of violence. And I'm glad for what David said, because oftentimes I'm stopped in the hallway by other professors, and they will say to me, Thal, what do you think? These students speak village English. Does this mean they can't do sequential writing? And so then we have to have a conversation where I have a whole class of students who can't do sequential writing, both native, non-native, mm-hmm. a whole group of people, and that's what we're here for, I guess, is to teach them how to do sequential writing. So we have to have these kinds of conversations, and I personally find them annoying as a Native American.
Robert, your thoughts on that?
I was just remembering what Mr. O'Rourke was saying. I think that sometimes we, even as Natives, put ourselves down, because when I was growing up, I didn't grow up in any Native families since I was 8 years old, about. And I grew up in all white foster homes. And I never really knew what Natives were, pretty much until I got to Fairbanks here. And actually, I didn't even know that there was this many Natives in Alaska, because I was growing up in Kenai, and there were some half-breeds there, and they weren't really culturally into their culture that much. And then I got up here and seen all the differences, and I never really even knew the difference between Athabascan and Eskimo. I knew there was differences, but I never really met any until I got up here. Well, like when I was growing up, and after high school, I was in Anchorage, and I met a lot of them. And the ones I met were mostly alcoholic in town, and so I didn't really see any culture there, except for the culture of alcohol. Then I got up here, or before that, in high school, I was pretty near the only Native in the Kenai High, and. Then one year, all of a sudden, there was a whole bunch of Natives that came into from the villages to the high schools, our high school. And we got about, there must have been about 250 Natives. And they were all village people from the villages, students. And I was looking at them, and I kind of knew that I was one of these people. And for instance, at one time, one of my friends, they said, well, Robert's not one of them. He's one of us, you know. And right in front of me, they would be using the names like the Klooch, Salmon Cruncher, and all those names back in the 70s that they used. I haven't heard it these days. Back then in high school, they used that a lot, even in front of me, because I was their friend, so I didn't fit into the Native.
You were just Robert, so yeah. You weren't a Native mm-hmm. person.
And then I got up here, and I started meeting a lot of Natives, and mostly Athabascan. And I started realizing that they have their culture, and I was starting to see what their culture was like. And a lot of times people have said, well, the cultures are going. And I knew that they're not, because they're changing a bit, but they're not leaving, you know. And It's just that I was prejudiced myself. I mean, I already had an idea what Indians and Eskimos were. And when I first started meeting Natives, I thought they were a bit odd, you know, because I grew up with white people and I was thinking like them and I was the whole thing. And I thought their accents were a little weird, you know, the first time I heard village accents and village language. And at first I thought they were dumb because of this, because I didn't really know what was going on. And then after a while I realized, well, there's nothing wrong with them, it's just how they are. And and even now I can tell differences between in accents and where people are from. And it took me a while to realize that these people weren't lower forms or I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And
do these stereotypes that we create, and I guess I'm asking this of everyone, these stereotypes that we create in advance of knowing someone,
mm-hmm,
block us from any compassion, any meeting Robert as Robert?
That's kind of what I was doing. I was stereotyping. And even now I have a hard time with it, because I hear somebody speaking and they've been in the village all their life, and I hear the English is not very, very good. And they're actually, the reason why is because they never use English. Last Christmas I was in the village and I didn't hear an English word for 2 weeks. And then, then you expect them to come to Fairbanks where nobody speaks their language. And of course they're going to have problems, you know, they're going to feel inadequate, they're going to feel not as intelligent, the whole thing. Like when they come to the university from the village, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to be vulnerable to a lot of things.
David?
I'd respond to your question. Yeah, I think stereotyping keeps us from responding to human beings. Human beings are complex. They don't know what they aspire to. They're conflicted. They don't know what's good for them. They make the decisions as they go along on an existential basis as they run into things. And when we have a stereotype and we think a person, because he or she is a member of a particular group, particularly if it's a culturally different group, we relate to them as though they were that stereotype, not as though they were that kind of a human being. So we end up not giving them the room to be human, to make the kinds of mistakes and decisions and have the uncertainties and complexities that we all not only have but cherish if we have the opportunity to do it. And I would also like to respond, add to Valerie's notion of violence. Don't forget psychological violence and what happens to people as individuals when a society is convinced and works in subtle ways to convince them that they are somehow inferior in some way. And we see, and that leads to real violence, which we see in suicide, failure, alcoholism, a whole lot of things. And the horror of it is that we then convince these people that it's their problem, and this violence that they're inflicting is theirs, without recognizing that we as a society, and particularly those of us who are members of the dominant society, have to take the responsibility, and it's ultimately our problem. That they're victims, not perpetrators.
Patrick.
I'm not sure that we have adequately found a way to teach people to understand and appreciate cultural differences without minimizing individual differences in the process of it, so that sometimes, as well-meaning as we may be as a university in terms of preparing rural teachers to understand that they're going to see students from another culture, and there are certain elements of this culture that would be worthwhile for them to know about, we perhaps don't stress enough that within any culture you're going to run a whole range of individual differences. And I sometimes wonder if in the process of cultural preparation we do a disservice at times. I really haven't come to a conclusion on that. It's more of a question.
Val Montoya, you mentioned earlier when we were talking on the phone that with your students you've been working on a survey to gauge how comfortable minority groups are on this campus? And I know it's not complete, but can you talk in general terms on the results of that?
Well, I looked through my results and pulled out just some percentages. Would like to say that Robert was on an advisory committee with me on that study. Pretty much it's what both of them were saying, that not a whole lot of Native students here on campus actually rate racism as a highly stressful factor. We see more around like 20% saying that it is a problem. So it does occur to some extent, and they find it stressful, but seems to be more lower levels of stress. That doesn't mean that I don't know if I would go as far to say that it's not stressful. It's maybe there's some sort of a cumulative effect. I don't think this study is designed to test that.
I think a lot of times that's maybe part of that 20% is stress developed by themselves, by their own imagination, because a lot of times I can see something happening and it wouldn't have anything to do with racism, but I can, from the way I grew up and from what I've seen, I can stereotype people and say, oh, they don't like Natives, just from, and that could be not true at all. That could not be at all what was really happening.
But you mentioned earlier that vulnerability that I think perhaps to greater and lesser extents many of us in this room have felt. And I think you do, when you're vulnerable in that way, make assumptions about where the slight is coming from, that it is racially motivated or culturally motivated or gender motivated or having something else to do with your difference. Because we do tend to, we're egoistic beings. We start with the self, so we assume that someone's not liking us because of something about ourselves. Val, you mentioned on the phone that this study, one of the results of this study was that these stresses in general were not unmanageable. The Native students felt they weren't unmanageable. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, I would just again say that they don't report high levels of stress and it is manageable. They are coping with a situation. They find any number of ways of coping. Sometimes redefining whether or not it is actually racism occurring, or just choosing to ignore it, or actually confronting a person who they think is racist and talking to them about what's occurred. Maybe it is a miscommunication, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to say, though, that I think it is a social phenomenon. It is an individual phenomenon, so I wouldn't necessarily reduce it to a matter of individual perceptions. It is definitely a social phenomenon in the sense that there's a lack of interaction or communication between social groups.
Mm-hmm. I think Robert was pointing out, though, that it works both ways, that we tend to diminish ourselves for fear that someone else is diminishing us at the same time that society tends to diminish. I mean, it does it on large, and then we abet it individually.
Right.
By saying, yes, you're right, I'm only I'm lesser than because of what I am.
Right.
By our own imagination.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think a lot of times that imagination is based on experience.
And continual reinforcement by the institution or by the society.
Yes, that's the point.
Of course you are. Yes, you are. Yes, you are less than you think you want to be.
I guess, though, I'm still find myself concerned by the number of white students who graduate and leave this university probably never having made a real contact with someone from another culture. And in a way, they've lost something in the process of that, because there is a whole richness of culture that could add to their education, and that they haven't taken full advantage of it, and that perhaps we as a university haven't found the right mechanisms to make it happen more freely and easily. Now, conversely, I would say it's probably very difficult for an Alaska Native student to graduate this university just because of sheer numbers without having made a contact the other way across culture with a white student or a number of white students. And I think that's just a function of numbers to some extent. And so again, it doesn't seem to be an equal street.
I'd like to take up what Pat said. We're engaged in the university right now in the development of a baccalaureate core curriculum. I have been thought about this a number of times, but I think we're missing a tremendous opportunity. We want our students to get into liberal arts because they develop skills of critical thinking. You can't be raised and exist on a northern tundra without having developed very important skills of critical thinking. Why aren't we thinking about some incorporation of that into it? I could go on. There are a whole number of areas like that. Right now, we're concerned that a lot of our native students are having trouble with math and science. And yet, the ways of thinking with respect to the universe and its construction and organization that are characteristic of Native Alaskans would qualify a village elder to be a fellow at the Princeton Center for Advanced Study, because they're way ahead of the movement in quantum physics and quantum mechanics that we're beginning to come to. I don't know where that all leads to, but it would be nice if we could find some way to find in our university a way to view the presence of Alaska Natives not as a problem to have to be addressed and dealt with, but as an incredible opportunity for us as a we hope, an aspiring major university.
More of an asset, you're saying.
That's right.
That was one of the things that I was... catching what you were saying, there are a lot of ways of doing things and thinking things that are different, that are really unique. And like you were saying, the Native people throughout Alaska and anywhere else have developed ways of surviving and ways of thinking that are unique and that would benefit the students here. And we were talking about how I've previously on the phone call, and you called me up before, about how I felt about getting more Native instructors. Mm-hmm. And I think getting up for some of the students that are coming up from the lower 48 and other places, it's going to be a different type of thinking, and it's going to be an enriching experience. And I think, like you said, they would be missing out on something valuable like that. I think it's something worth looking into.
How is this done? We have very few, if any, Native faculty within the University of Alaska Fairbanks system, and that includes Bethel, Kotzebue, and Nome. How do we move towards a higher number of Native faculty members in this economic environment, in a political environment that's biased towards the majority population, and it's biased towards PhD educators? Open it up.
I'm suggesting, I don't want to dominate.
David Smith?
We aren't going to change by changing the myths. I'm not going to go into a lecture as a professor on that, because myths are developed to support behaviors. They don't ultimately govern behaviors. And I think we make a mistake when we think that we're going to make the changes we change the myth. We're going to change it by taking some action. We have to find some ways to get people into some of these positions. I think we have to do what Pat talked about with respect to education. I would change one word. He said we have to appreciate and understand cultural differences. I would delete understand, because I think that becomes a trap. We have to appreciate and respect and start considering as legitimate and rational culturally different behaviors, whether we understand them or not, and whether it's culturally different or individually different. And I think we have to get some of this philosophy into our curriculum, but the main thing, I think, we have to find ways to cut through and just get some Native people in positions of where they have influence.
I'd hate to see that happen, Native people to get into positions just because they are Native. I mean, I think that would be worse for me, anyways, because then it would be patronizing, and it would be just they're. I don't know what other way there would be, like Native hire and things like that. A lot of Native corporations do that, but that's for them, that's the Native corporation. as far as the university goes, how do you hire a native and without patronizing them at the same time?
I'd like to say I think there's probably a lot of qualified native people out there who could be professors or instructors here on this campus, and I think what we need is a really active recruiting process, as well as a committee that's made up of diverse people to review hiring practices. That's what I think we need.
Pat O'Rourke, your hand is up.
I have some empathy with both points being expressed, and I've been kicking around an idea that maybe bridges the ground. I take Robert's point very well. I don't think Alaska Native people want to feel that they have been patronized. Yet I think when they look from outside the institution at the institution and don't see many Alaska Native faculty members at the university level, they may be questioned whether or not the university is receptive to them. So an idea that I've been bouncing around is to try to, if you will, open the spigot. We have a high cadre of, a cadre of Alaska Native people who have completed master's degrees in appropriate disciplines and have some very good experience. We've been kicking around a notion of a form of pre-hire program that might run something along the lines of identifying some of these individuals who would qualify upon completion of a doctoral program for some faculty positions, that we should invest on the front end in terms of providing support for them to pursue that final advanced degree, with the idea that upon completion of that, they would return to the university in the department, which in essence hired them in advance, and would provide at least a year for year service for each year of support outside. And again, it's trying to cut a middle ground between our need, I think, as an institution to attract to us some of these individuals, but yet respect the point that Robert made, too, that he doesn't want to achieve that just because he's Alaska Native, but to know that he has also done it on its own merits. And I don't know what anyone thinks about that type of
approach.
The
Indian Health Service does it that way. For every year that you go to school, they're paying for the school.
You owe them a year of service.
Yeah, you work a year for them.
Mm-hmm.
I'd kind of like to add something else that occurred to me. I know of two Native professors here on this campus who haven't stayed more than a couple of years. I think there's definitely a lack of a supportive environment here for Native faculty, and I think that would have to be addressed, as well as trying to try new recruiting and reviewing hiring practices.
What about David Smith's thought? And in talking to both Robert and Phil earlier today, I got the feeling that you two also agree of coursework which reflects the Native culture. David, you brought up people who know more about the winds and the snow and the weather than people at MIT might know because of their experience daily in it. Are there course ideas? And of course we have to consider this economic climate again, but is this an enhancing idea for you two as students or for the rest of you as faculty?
One little bit of an adjustment. I'm not so much concerned of what they know, is the fact of how they view things, which is turning out to be the issue that is of great concern today as we look at what we've done with our Western technology and our Western, scientism as the basis for our education, what we've done to the universe. That was one area that I'm concerned about. But they have a real contribution to make there.
Phil?
Yeah, I've taken a lot of Native Studies courses here, and the majority of the courses that I've taken were taught by non-natives, mm-hmm. And it's kind of ironic that some of the things that that were being taught to us, they read out of a book, they didn't experience it. I'm sure that they're well qualified as instructors, but in certain areas there's no experience. I mean, they haven't lived and lived the experiences, and I think their point of view and their perspectives are a little different than would be from a native instructor. And we've had native people come into some of the classes as guest speakers, and the point of view that they brought was totally different than some of the points of views that the instructors had. And so, I don't know.
Can I add to what Phil says? As an instructor, sometimes I will also audit some of the Native Studies classes just to increase my awareness of what issues are important to people up here, the indigenous people up here in Alaska. And I look around the classroom, and most of the students are Native. And so I find that really interesting. I never see any other faculty in these classes either.
And very few white students.
Right. So those are two issues I'd like to raise. In terms of looking at curriculum as an instructor myself, I think we need to have the knowledge of Native people incorporated into all classes. We shouldn't have just specialized programs. And also I think we need some sort of orientation programs for people new to the UAF community. I remember coming here as an instructor for the first time, kind of looking forward to, quote, orientation. But orientation wasn't really orientation, it was orientation to paperwork. Mm-hmm. And really never got support from the university to find out about Alaska Natives. So I think we need to address that sort of thing. I think instructors have a responsibility to pursue that information for themselves, and that the university should support them in doing that. And I remember sitting in one faculty development seminar with just a handful of other instructors looking at how to incorporate issues of gender into classes. And so the same thing again. I mean, we didn't even have a seminar for incorporating Alaska Native knowledge into classes, but hopefully maybe that will happen sometime soon.
I guess I agree with the point that Val expressed, that I think for curriculum to be done correctly, it must be inbred into all aspects of curriculum, so that when you teach the history of Alaska, you're not teaching it singularly from a white perspective, that you're also addressing the important elements that predated the Russians and are significant events overall in the history of this state. When we teach child development to our aspiring teachers, that we look not just at Middle American child development, but we look at a variety of cultures and child development practices that might differ within that, including all of the Alaska Native cultures as well. And I think that inbred piece of it has to occur. I'm optimistic that I see signs of it occurring in a number of disciplinary areas, perhaps not all, but I do see some signs of it. One other thought that Phil triggered, and certainly just listening to he and Robert and observing my prior comment that too frequently our white students miss the opportunity to gain a multicultural experience, that we should probably more actively pursue a cultural seminar series through the various residence halls, utilizing our existing resources to foster that type of interaction and exchange.
One comment. I'm still a little concerned. I agree totally with you about our incorporating a native component or whatever it is, or native knowledge into all of our curriculum. We have to make sure that doesn't end up reinforcing the stereotypes. You talked about history. We also need to get native historiography. It's not just the role of natives in history, but native views of history and what that means and how it differs from a white Western views of history, just to use an example.
Yeah, it's kind of, I've long wondered if the anthropologist, when he or she first observed another culture, really saw the culture as it was, or whether that first moment of observation and was an interaction that then changed it.
Certainly they didn't. I couldn't have described it. The culture can't be described as it really is, and so there's a basic problem there.
Robert, your thoughts?
Well, there's two things that that came up here, well, that I thought about. Well, just the word cross-cultural communication, it's always seemed to me that that we have to cross from our culture to the white culture when we come here. And it's not really cross-cultural. It's, you know, it's kind of like we have to learn how to do things in this university. And I don't really see any other way of actually doing it other than, like I said, patronizing the natives. Because from going from one culture to the other, after a while it ends up, after they've gone through school here and they've made it through the 4 years or however many years they've gone, it seems like they've changed, and of course they're going to be changing since they've been to school. But it seems to me they've changed for the worst a lot of times, because they end up not going back to the villages, and they're going to work for. They're here. They've learned that to make it in this world, they have to make a lot of money.
You talked earlier about native students who let their nativeness slip away under the influence of the white culture.
Yeah. And I don't know how this university could help that, other than what we do have rural student services, and there's a festival of Native arts with the university supports it quite a bit. And I don't know, I don't really see any solution to having the culture slip away from them, other than having to do it themselves, having to remember who they are at all times, you know, where they came from, who their people are. And a lot of times, just going to school and living in a town kind of slows that down quite a bit, you know.
What do the rest of you think? Is it possible for a university to build a bridge for Native Alaskans to academic achievement, and at the same time have a lane on that bridge returning home again? I mean, that's a huge thing to ask an institution, but it certainly does respond to the impact of the institution.
I've heard from a lot of students that it's really hard. Sometimes when they leave to go to school, they lose time. People look at them differently. They're treated differently when they go back home. There's an adjustment period, and they're viewed as being different, and they are treated different. And some of the students that I've talked to, the ones that have really become homesick and have wanted to go home, miss a lot of things that they've grown up with, like fishing or hunting, or, you know, it's springtime and they're really homesick, and, you know, that they don't have the opportunity to do that here. So that's a lot of stress on them, and then when they go back, they're facing stress when they get home because people are treating them a little different. So they're stressed when they're here because they're missing what they're accustomed to doing, you know, as the season changes and as the year goes on, but at the same time, they're faced with another problem when they get home.
Pat O'Rourke.
I sometimes think that depending on a field of study that Alaska Native students choose, that they're faced again with a dual choice of take theater, just as a more wild example. If one wishes to major in theater, the opportunities to go home and practice one's profession then become relatively limited. And that wasn't the type of situation that I had to face. I could, in a way, carry that with me to similar cultural areas and have my profession. In some professions, a student is forced to make a choice between more close involvement with the majority of his culture or her culture and professional area. Engineering might be a more practical example in terms of an Alaska Native engineer. If he or she wishes to practice as an engineer, there aren't as many opportunities in one's home village or home city to do so as there will be in urban. And I'm not sure we've learned how to adapt work environments to balance both.
I can't answer the question so precisely, but I can suggest some process that might work toward it. And one is if we really can seriously recognize the legitimacy of being Native, we find ways to allow Native voice to have a larger place in the shaping of the institutional mission and in other practices and policies that are important to giving the university its flavor. And we also might think about giving more Native voice to some of the programs. This is a land-grant university. We have an obligation not just to be passing out knowledge, but also to serving the state in some ways, giving maybe more Native voice to the cooperative extension mission, to our rural development, economic development missions and projects and so on. I'm just thinking about that right now. I don't know how much that's done, but I think that's an area that we need to think about.
So your thought is to expand the vision of the university to include the village of the Native Alaskan people as well. Val Montoya, your thoughts?
Yes, I kind of agree with David that it is a process. And I know, Susan, you asked me earlier on the phone whether or not it's possible to have a multicultural university, and my response to you was that the question was moot, and that the fact that we have to have it, and the question is really how are we going to do it? And it is a process. I think we have to, as instructors, teach our students to be more open to learning about different cultures, different people. I think education is a transformation process for everyone, Natives and non-Natives. And I, as a Native American, I feel it's important that we do provide a quality education to all Native people, and that the health of our Native communities, in fact, relies on a diverse set of skills. And so I just feel very strongly that, enough to put that right out, that we do need to have a diverse set of skills among Native people. We can go through a process, I think, at the University of developing an environment that's more open, more accepting of all kinds of people. And I think we do it through curriculum, hiring practices, extracurricular activities. So I think it is, we have to do it.
Little of everything. You talked about in your sociology class talking to students about racism. And
I teach an introduction to sociology class, and I always have one set of students who themselves do a section on looking at racism. And one of the most successful exercises we've ever done is, well, first off, everybody kind of trying to come to the idea that they've been discriminated some way or another, whether it's on the base of class or gender, culture, or race, whatever. So that's one kind of process we work through. Also, what we do is also develop vignettes, have students read through the vignettes and come up with their own set of policies for dealing with racism. And the students, of course, we have to deal with, first off, a fear of each student being called a racist. But once we get past that, the students are really open to learning and really beginning to know what another person might be experiencing, because they've probably experienced it too. But in developing their own set of policies of how they're going to deal with racism in an active way, I think it kind of generates a sense of ownership of what those practices should be.
Thank you, Val. We have about 5 minutes left, and I want to use the time to talk about the University of Alaska Fairbanks and where it's where it is doing very well with cultural relations. We have spent the better part of an hour talking about the problems, and it's justified. It's reasonable. But each of you has said to me on the phone differently when we have been talking that this is also a very good campus for students of all cultures. Your thoughts? I'm not trying to end this as a Pollyanna, but I would like to have that other side brought in. Robert?
Well, for instance, I've worked with the Festival of Native Arts for the last 3 years, and I've really enjoyed it a lot. And it takes a lot of my time and schoolwork away from me. It takes almost 2 weeks of my time that I'm spending intensely with the festival. And one good thing about it is that I can go to some of the professors and I can say I've been working with the festival and I've become really involved with it. And sometimes they've not been lax on my schoolwork, but they have been accepting is what's happening. You know, they can I do this paper a little later or that mm-hmm. type of a thing. You know, and so at least they've done that, and also they have rural student services, and that's I think is a good. It's helped a lot of native students.
Inasmuch because some of our listeners will not know rural student services.
Oh, a lot of natives go up there and they have counselors and tutors. They have six computers that natives can use, and it's right around the Native Studies area in that area, and it's kind of a place where people can come and sit. Or they can do their homework or pretty much anything they want. I spend a lot of time there myself.
Mm-hmm. It's the warmest, most congenial spot on campus.
Do you think so overall?
Yeah.
That's very nice.
I would agree.
To answer your question, I think one thing that distinguishes this university in a very positive sense, having come from an Ivy League university that I didn't feel this at all, is the kind of the clear institutional commitment from the top. The Chancellor's Office, we have a College of Rural Alaska that is predicated upon the notion that we have a mission. That's in addition to these other things that are mentioned. And whereas I see shortcomings being great, it's a lot easier to work in a context and where there is a stated mission and support of equality and addressing some of these issues.
Thank you, David Smith. We just have 1 minute left. Has anyone a last thought? Phil? Sharad?
Well, one of the best things I see about the university is the opportunity that gives the students a lot of opportunities to explore a lot of different areas and find out what direction they're going to want to go and how they can deal with a lot of these issues that we're talking about. Getting other ideas of how to look at these issues, different points of view, different perspectives.
Thank you. I want to thank you all. Robert Galachinov, graduating this year in social work and going on to work here for a couple of years before going to graduate school. We wish you the best and thanks for joining us today. Phil Charette, also a graduating student in secondary education and Native Studies, hoping to teach for a couple of years in Alaska and then go on to graduate school as well. Thanks for taking time. We wish you the best. Valerie Montoya, Assistant Professor of Sociology, Chancellor Pat O'Rourke, thank you both for coming. And Professor of Education David Smith, also President of the Faculty Senate. We've spent this last hour talking about cultural relations on the University of Alaska campus. I hope the conversation continues. I'm Susan McInnes. I'm your host for Sunday at Noon. For my engineer, John Christopite, we hope you have a good Sunday. A reminder that Sunday at Noon is supported in part by grants provided to the KUAC FM Programming Fund. Enjoy your Sunday. Next week, we talk with poet and poetry critic Robert Haas. Join us then.